Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host. I hope you're doing well. Most of you know that I've been working to continually improve the sound quality of the show. And I recently made a pretty serious investment in some equipment. So I'm hoping that this day going forward, there will be no more problems. You will have good sound. Now, we know the Blog Talk Radio Network has HD, hi-fi, and keeps pretty good controls over how things are sounding, how things are being reproduced. So I've been doing a tremendous amount of testing this week, and so the sound quality should be excellent. But you know what? Let me know. Send me an email, cliff at earthancients.com. Go, hey, Cliff, this sounds great. Or Cliff, no, it's still tweaking, whatever. Hey, it's the only way I'm going to know if we have quality sound. So I'm done my part. Sounds good to me. Sounds good to the technicians in New York. I'm out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So what we need is for you to let us know if it's good or not. And so far, I've got all thumbs up on this one, and I think we've hit a home run. So let us know. Let me know, Cliff at earthancients.com. You know, just say, hey, Cliff, it sounds great. Love your guest. Oh, and by the way, if you're looking at this book or that book, we're interested in this. I'd be interested to hear more about this person. I'd love to hear who you're interested in so that I have a heads up as to really what you're interested in hearing. I have my hands on the pulse of a lot of the up and coming stuff. Well-known authors, bestsellers and things like that. But there's always, I have a niche. I have an interest too. I mean, hey, here's an example. The Black Knight Satellite is on everyone's mind. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the Black Knight Satellite right now, because I am in the final phases of completing a book. It's an ebook. It's not even, I think it's about 150 pages. So, and the reason I wrote this book, and we're in the final phases of editing, is there's a tremendous amount of confusion about this satellite, where it came from, who's been in contact with it, and really what the United States government knows and doesn't know. And I uncovered an amazing amount of information that I just want everyone to know. We were quite heavily involved with researching and studying the Black Knight satellite. But there's a lot of fallacy. I mean, this whole issue around Tesla is false. The confusion comes around a phenomenon known as long delayed echoes, which is a phenomenon that I discussed quite a bit. In the 1920s, when Tesla was doing his thing, there were a number of people that were picking up these echoes, and we had Duncan Lunan on the show, who's the scientist who actually interpreted those echoes and was the one who created the map, had nothing to do with Tesla. And it drives me nuts. I see it on our Facebook page, Earth Ancients, where people are like, well, Tesla was in, you know, communications with this thing. Well, we have no, there was no way to know in the 20s. We didn't have any long range radar until the late 40s, or actually early 50s, 1950s, when we began, you know, using the long range radar to not only determine what's circling and orbiting the Earth, but also to track our own satellites. And the Russians too. Sputnik, remember Sputnik, or the early Explorer, Explorer 1, Explorer 2, America's first attempt to shoot a device into the atmosphere. That's when we knew there was something in the air. So anyhow, in the sky, in the space. So anyhow, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a ton of other really interesting subjects that, we can cover. So let me know. Cliff at earthancients.com. I have been working and thinking about a sponsor for a number of months as Earth Ancients has continued to grow. We're at a 250,000 downloads since I think it was October last year. And it continues to grow. And I want to thank you for supporting the show, for continually listening. And but a sponsor is always helpful because it allows me to expand the offering. It gives me an opportunity to invest in things. Like, we have a new website that's coming out, supposed to come out in June, but it's not going to be out now, probably till the end of the summer. But this website will have resources for you. It'll have an opportunity to go back and listen to earlier shows. It'll have a number of experts. We're going to have Dr. John Brandenburg, the space expert who talks about Mars. He'll be one of the regular contributors. Dr. Heather Lynn, the archaeologist, will be part of our team. So that website will be great. But the point I'm trying to make is a sponsor allows for all these kinds of things. And when I was thinking about sponsors, I was like, okay, do I want to be pushing suds, soaps, alcohol, cars? And when I thought about it, really, the two key sponsors for the show would be, one, a publisher of books that I'm promoting and having authors on about. And two would be touring, because these places that I'm speaking about, that we're talking about each week, are the homes to ruins of ancient cultures. Are many of them are continually being excavated. When I first started traveling to Central America, I was, the first time in 1995 that I went to Yucatan and went to Chichen Itza, I was totally in awe. I mean, I was dumbfounded. In fact, it was the beginning of a 10-year quest that I started taking, where I would go down every summer for a month and work with the Maya, and also work with excavation teams, and really, really dive into everything Maya. But that was my experience. And some of the best tours, the best times going down there were with tour companies. And it's one of the best and most beneficial ways to tour an ancient site. And so I'm announcing my first my first sponsor, which is a tour company. And I want to introduce you to Ancient Mysteries International, which is a company that was developed by Bruce Cunningham, the president. And Bruce and I have been talking back and forth, and it's amazing because he is going to be doing a tour in Indonesia. And guess where he is going to be going? He's going to Gunung Penang. And this tour is November 30th through December 6th. And as you all know, we had Dr. Danny Hillman on the show telling us about this ruin, this pyramid. And isn't it funny that last week we had George Schwimmer talking about none other than Lemuria and Mu. And remember him saying he believed that they also were a pyramid culture. So anyhow, my sponsor, and we're hoping for many weeks with support, is Ancient Mysteries International. And I want to just tell you a little bit about this tour. It is, it's November 30th, as I mentioned. Danny Hillman, Dr. Hillman, is the chief geologist, archaeologist, and excavator of this pyramid, Gunung Padang. And you will be able to walk on it. You'll be able to work with him. You'll be able to see exactly what they have been excavating. And this is like an amazing opportunity. Now, not only is Danny part of the program, the producer and the director of the Pyramid Code, Dr. Carmen Bolter, will be on the tour also. She will be talking about pyramids. She will be interacting. And I spoke to Carmen just a few days ago. She is our guest August 1st for a full program on the Pyramid Code. So stay tuned for that, by the way, August 1st, Saturday. But Carmen's part of the tour, and Danny's there, and they're going to be going all over the place. So happens to be one of the most amazing tours I've ever heard of, because everyone's going to Egypt, okay? Some people are going to South America, but there's really no tour companies that are over there in the Pacific, visiting these islands. And I'd like to bring on the president of Ancient Mysteries International, Bruce Cunningham. Hi, Bruce. How you doing?
Well, hey, Cliff. How you doing?
Great. Great. Hey, so this is a fantastic tour. And by the way, I want to welcome you to the Earth Ancients family, and we're really looking forward to working with you. But I want to know a little bit about you. How did you get involved in the tour business, and where have you been? This tour in Jakarta or Java, Indonesia looks amazing.
Well, basically, I got into this. I mean, I had read von Däniken's book back when I was a kid, by 70, 71, and was always interested in these ancient sites, not knowing that people could actually go there. I mean, what Eric did in the early days, he had to be a true explorer because they weren't touristy like today. And a few years ago, I decided to start having some conferences, because I've always been interested in bringing different authors and presenters together as speakers at these conferences. Mm-hmm. And I have a home over in Southeast Asia in the Philippines. So I had went to Angkor Wat several years ago, and I've been there many times since, and it was just jaw-dropping, just completely mm-hmm. jaw-dropping, the amount of temples and the carvings. And so I've done two tours there, and I want to do tours in that area of the world that have these amazing sites that nobody's been to.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what they can expect with you? I mean, as an example, your most recent tour was to where? I'm sorry, where was like was it a year ago, your last tour?
No, this March I had Hugh Newman from Megalithomania and the great research author Andrew Collins as my host into okay. Angkor Wat and the Angkor Archaeological Park in Siem Reap, and we also went up to this amazing temple in northeast Cambodia or northwest Cambodia called Priya Vihear.
Wow.
And
fantastic.
I mean, it was just incredible.
So when someone books with you, and by the way, the phone number to call Ancient Mysteries International is area code 260-417-8548. And they'll take care of you and give you more information as you need it. And the website for details is ancientmysteriesinternational.net, N-E-T, not .com, .net. And you'll learn all about it. I don't know of anyone who's actually been to touring at Ganon Pandang. Now, the flyer that I see here actually shows Danny is the Dr. Danny Hillman, not a Wood with Jedja, is the lead geologist, and he's actually touring. He's actually doing the tour. But you have a breakout session, don't you? We are actually doing a conference. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically, the first day will just be kind of hang out at Jakarta, get rid of the jet lag, and go to the National Museum in Jakarta. Then the very next day, we'll be going to where Danny Hillman has his office and university, and we'll be doing a conference there. There will be Danny speaking, Dr. Carmen, and my main guide, who will be the tour guide throughout the tour, Danny Erwanto, and he's a author, and he will be speaking also.
Okay, so Danny is the actual lead guide. I guess he lives out there, right? So he'll be showing everybody what the temples and the pyramids and things like that. Okay.
Yeah, he has been all over Indonesia, and he has been sending me just amazing pictures of all these different ancient sites that no one's aware of. In fact, last time he sent me a couple, and I just keep telling Danny, "You're killing me. You're just killing me here."
Wow. You know, it's funny because we had Dr. Hillman on the show, and they keep finding older dates. I think on your brochure, it's the 23,000-year-old pyramid, but I think it was actually dated to 28 in the last series of carbon dating. But it continues to get older and older, which kind of makes you think of Mu or Lemuria as maybe the center point. What do you say about that?
Well, basically, I had found out this about this several years ago, this Gunung Padang, from the author Frank Joseph. He'd sent me some information, so didn't know a lot about it. And at that time, it was being dated to like 12,000. And as they keep going down different levels, it just keeps getting dated older and older. I mean, it's hard to say where it will stop, because the excavations have only been maybe just less than 5 years. I mean, so it's at the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, and as a participant in the tour, I mean, I would think that you get pretty good access to that pyramid, right? I mean, I know that you have to, it takes a good amount of time to get up on top, but are you expecting that the participants can maybe see some of the excavation points?
Oh, without a doubt, having Danny, you know, Dr. Danny Hillman, who is the chief geologist there, they'll have total access.
In fact, amazing.
We have plans with the other sites we're going, the Borobudur Temple and the Kandisuka Temple, that we plan to have academic representatives from the local universities in those areas to be part of the tour, so we have access to everything.
Wow, fantastic. Well, I think it's amazing. We're going to be promoting it. I'm going to work with you to maybe have a live feed from the conference, maybe get an interview with Danny, Dr. Bolter, and you, and maybe a couple of tour participants, just to get a sense of what you're experiencing. Maybe you have some new revelations. I've been posting some of these interesting tools and objects that seem to be composed of unusual stone. They may even be artificial that have been discovered at that pyramid. And you know, we can learn a little bit about it before it becomes major news on the internet and goes viral. We'll have like an inside track to you. So fantastic, Bruce. It's going to be a pleasure working with you. Our listeners, what I'm going to do is each week we're going to post some photographs of some of Bruce's past tours, and make sure that you have every opportunity to sign up for this. Now, what is the maximum number of participants on this tour that you'll take? I think you have a few people that have registered, but you're ready to start taking some more registrations. What's the max, like 30 people, 20 people? I forget what you said.
Basically, I tried to do more intimate tours. 20 will be the maximum.
I mean, okay.
So if we have like a half a dozen, a dozen, whatever we get, my tours are a little different, as you will experience culture. I mean, we're not just going to some five-star hotel and hang out. We're going to actually, like in Angkor Wat, several of the days, the guests went on tuk-tuks, which is the way the locals live there. So my tours are kind of like an exploration in many ways.
Okay.
So you know, or an adventure, I guess, would be a better word.
Okay.
But yeah.
And when a potential tourist goes with you beforehand, they get an idea of what the food's going to be like and what they're living and bedding and choices of overnight accommodations and things like that. So sounds like,
yes,
that's great. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I am looking forward to hearing more, and Ancient Mysteries International is our sponsor. You'll be hearing me talk about it. We'll have little promotions and do look on the Earth Ancients Facebook page for more details and some amazing photographs, including this tour promotion. It's the Java Indonesian tour with Dr. Danny Hillman and Dr. Carmen Bolter. A fantastic opportunity to tour probably one of the sites of a groundbreaking pyramid as more information comes out about it. It's November, the tour is November 30th. Through December 6th, and it's visiting the oldest pyramid dated to date. He's 23,000 years old, and it is, I can't imagine how cool that'll be. Ancient Mysteries International. Thanks, Bruce. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to having you on the program again.
Okay, I look forward to it too, and I just want to quickly say that this will be the first organized tour ever to the Gunung Padang site.
Really? Oh, that's huge.
Yes.
Okay. We got to make sure people know about that.
And I also have an early bird special for those that are truly interested. They can get on it with very significant savings on this tour. All inclusive.
Fantastic. So they'll find out about that by calling 260-417-8548. All right, fantastic. We'll have you on again, and just before you take off, we'll get some more information. Maybe I think what we'll do is maybe have you on with Carmen when she's on in a couple of weeks, and we can talk a little more about this tour. Sounds fantastic.
All right, good talking to you, Cliff.
Thanks, Bruce. So that's Bruce Cunningham, the president of Ancient Mysteries International. And you know, really, if you want to explore and experience these places, you can't ask for a better way to do it than taking a guided tour. And what's even better is you have the experts with you. You have Danny Hillman, who's the foremost authority on the Gunung Padang pyramid. And who else to talk about pyramids than the producer, writer, and director of The Pyramid Code, Dr. Carmen Bolter. Wow. So give them a call, 260-417-8548. Boy, that's very cool. So today we're going to be talking with Dr. Rick Strassman. And this was a pre-recording that was done just a couple of days ago. I want you to really listen to what he has to say. He's a clinical psychiatrist. He speaks in very profound language, which is very clinical, and you have to really listen to what he has to say about how DMT affects the brain. And not only that, what he believes was perhaps the cause and the trigger effect of prophecy. And this new book he's writing wrote about and is out now is called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And I'm not going to spend too much more time on discussing it because we have an hour ahead of us that basically will give us profound information about it. But DMT is was written about in his first book. He wrote a book called DMT and the Spirit Molecule. And in that book, he chronicles the number of years he worked with research volunteers and actually seeing how this this drug interacted with the mind. And there's a number of eye-opening statements he makes, but I'm not going to talk too much more about it. So I'll go ahead and start this here, and I'll come back after the after the interview and give you a little more information on our next show and some current events. So this is the interview with Dr. Rick Strassman. I hope you enjoy it.
My guest today is Dr. Rick Strassman, and many of you might know him from his first book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And I read that book, and it was quite an eye-opener, quite a detailed account of what is how things are evolving in terms of understanding how our brain works, specifically the pineal gland. And this new work, this new book that we're talking about today is called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And and the subtitle is A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. Dr. Strassman performed the first new human studies with the psychedelic naturally occurring compound DMT. He's the author, as I mentioned, of The Spirit Molecule and co-author of Inner Paths to Outer Space. He's currently the clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico of Medicine. And I believe you're coming to us today from Taos, New Mexico. Is that correct?
From Gallup, actually, out in the western side of the state.
Okay. Well, welcome to the program. Really a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks, Cliff.
I want to kind of dive a little bit into the actual properties of DMT. Can you give us a real layman's overview of DMT, the properties of this chemical, and how it causes these amazing reactions in our brain?
Well, so DMT stands for dimethyltryptamine. It's a pretty simple compound chemically. It's not much larger than blood sugar or glucose. It is a naturally occurring compound. It's found in hundreds, if not thousands, of plants. it was first discovered in psychoactive plants in the 1940s. Plants which had been collected in Latin America. But it wasn't until 1955 or so that it was discovered to be psychedelic, which took place in Hungary at the time because a psychiatrist who was interested in studying LSD couldn't get access to it because of him being behind the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. And in his, reading the literature, he had an inclination that DMT, could be psychoactive, and he experimented on himself and discovered its, psychedelic properties. It was still kind of a curiosity, it wasn't, nowhere near as popular as LSD, and within, recreational, circles or within the academic community. But that began to change in the mid 1960s or so when DMT was discovered in the tissues of rodents, living rodents, especially the rabbit lung. But still, it was not until it was also discovered to be occurring in human body fluids as well a few years after that. And as a result, it began to be investigated more carefully within the academic circles. And, it was also, it was also still, kind of obscure compound on the recreational drug use scene, even up until the 1980s or so. It's a small compound, as I mentioned, and it isn't an especially complicated one for the body to make. It begins with dietary tryptophan, which is an amino acid, and then that's converted in the body to tryptamine, and then a couple of methyl groups are added on to the tryptamine to make dimethyltryptamine. It's made primarily in the lungs. I had speculated in my first book about DMT being made in the pineal. And that was only discovered maybe 2 years ago or so. But in the meantime, it had been known for close to 60 years that DMT is made in the lungs.
Let me interrupt you just for a minute on that. Sure. If it's just been discovered in 2 years that it's made in the lungs, does it coalesce in the pineal gland? Is that the organ that basically is the center where it's stored? Or what? That's interesting that it would be generated in the lungs and then travel to the brain like that.
It is quite interesting. Well, especially when you think about the role of the breath in spiritual practices, and the close correlation between a lot of languages' use of the word lung, or I mean breath, and spirit. Oftentimes, those words mean the same thing. That's the case in Hebrew. Spirit and breath and wind are the same word. So the lungs, seem to be quite important in spiritual practices, spiritual physiology, as it were. It's interesting about, DMT, and it's being transported into the brain. It starts off in the lungs and then goes into the bloodstream, and then the brain expends energy getting, DMT into its confines, which is an unusual, characteristic of DMT. The brain only expends energy, getting compounds into its confines that it requires, which it is unable to make on its own, things like blood sugar and certain amino acids. So it seems as if, DMT is essential to normal brain function, so we can kind of revisit that issue. With respect to the pineal, so that was just discovered a couple of years ago in a laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And it was discovered in the pineal glands of living rodents that had, small probes, in place in the pineal gland. It still isn't 100%, certain, that the pineal gland is making DMT as opposed to it being, concentrated there, from the bloodstream. But, if you look at the rest of the brain and even the brain surrounding the pineal gland, there is no DMT. So it, makes, sense that DMT is being, made there. But still, that would require, some additional experiments.
Okay. That's fascinating. That's a good primer for our talk today. This new book, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, 20 years studying this psychedelic state in these volunteers. Was there a point in your research where you thought to yourself, there's something more going on here? There is a level of consciousness of unknown recordable states that we're aware of now that triggered this need to look at it on a deeper level, on a different kind of level, a level that is prophetic. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of this new book?
Well, sure. I performed my study from 1990 to 1995. So I completed the work and, took some time off to think about, what it all meant and you know,
right.
start to make some sense out of it.
Right.
You know, it was pretty crazy time. I mean, I gave a ton of DMT to a lot of people and wrote down a lot of trip reports. And, you know, the experiences that the volunteers underwent, you know, weren't really, you know, what either, you know, they expected or I expected. And, you know, the ways in which the actual DMT experience, you know, differed from our expectations were in, you know, two ways. One way was that it was quite an interactive and relational kind of an experience. Well, in our study, we gave the drug intravenously, and, you know, on the street, it smoked generally. But smoked or intravenous DMT, the effects begin within a few heartbeats, and they, you know, peak within about a minute or two, and then start resolving within around, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And then people feel, you know, mostly normal at the half hour or three quarters of an hour point. And the effects are quite, you know, sudden. You know, there's a rush, which I characterize by an intense, you know, feeling of inner pressure and acceleration, which then kind of culminates in the feeling that awareness is, you know, separated from the body, at which point, you know, people enter into a world of light, which, you know, seems, you know, full of intelligence. And oftentimes, you know, the kaleidoscopic, you know, figures or, you know, the kaleidoscopic designs evolve into, you know, formed shapes, which the volunteers refer to as beings or entities or creatures or those kinds of descriptions. And, you know, the awareness or the consciousness of the volunteer interacted with these beings, with these entities. You know, the majority of the volunteers had expected an enlightenment-like state, you know, based on their interest in and study of and, you know, practice of the Eastern religious, you know, meditations, which would be, you know, leading to an enlightenment-like state. And, you know, that state is, it's, you know, free of content. There's no, you know, form. There's no thinking. There's no feelings. There's no imagery. There's no self. It's, you know, timeless and spaceless. And, you know, because of, you know, my own, you know, background in Zen Buddhism, I was also expecting that kind of state to, you know, to be the ultimate, you know, DMT effect. And only you know, one of, you know, close to, you know, 5 dozen volunteers actually, you know, came back reporting, you know, that kind of an experience. You know, the enlightenment state is, you know, what I call the unitive, you know, mystical state of, you know, oneness or, you know, union, you know, with the ground of all being, as it were. You know, but instead it was an extremely interactive and relational experience. You know, so that was, you know, one way, you know, that the DMT effect, you know, differed from our expectations. The other way was that people were convinced of the reality of their experiences. You know, they were quite quick and quite, you know, firm in their description of the state as not being like a dream or not being like a hallucination or even not being like any other hallucinogenic or, you know, psychedelic, you know, drug experience, you know, that they had encountered in the past. You know, so the models that I had brought to bear on my studies to, you know, to understand, interpret, integrate the experiences of my volunteers, you know, fell short in you know, those two areas, you know, the reality, you know, feeling and the interactive nature of the state. You know, so
okay.
that, you know, then, you know, led me to start looking for other models, which ultimately, you know, led me to the Hebrew Bible.
Well, you're unique in that you were a practicing Buddhist and you followed those fundamentals. And so would you say that in the beginning you were using that model to kind of somewhat interpret your volunteers' experience and make it somewhat sensible?
Yeah.
Or was it, I mean, later you changed your feeling. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in the beginning, that was the foundation. Is that correct?
these three models that I had brought to bear on the studies, or, you know, these states I expected, you know, to result from the drug administrations in the studies, all three of them, you know, basically treat the visions and, you know, the voices as, you know, fundamentally unreal. The, you know, psychopharmacology model is kind of like, this is your brain on drugs. And as a result of getting, you know, DMT, you know, the brain, you know, generates these, you know, voices and the visions. And, you know, the other model, you know, was the, you know, psychoanalytic, or, you know, the psychological model, which in a way, you know, would interpret, you know, the visions and the voices, the content of the DMT state like a dream. It's a, you know, symbolic representation of unconscious conflicts or drives or impulses, those kinds of things. And the Buddhist model, which, well, you know, specifically the Zen Buddhist model, which, you know, treats the contents of the state as, you know, mental detritus kind of being, you know, shed on the way towards the formless enlightened state. You know, so, you know, all three of those were, which were the, you know, foundations of my understanding the effects, you know, propose, you know, that the experiences are unreal. And in my, you know, conversations with the volunteers after they came down from their drug state, you know, that kind of, you know, seeped into my approach, because I was responding to their stories as if, you know, they were something other, you know, than what they had just undergone. And I think even that slight bit of skepticism on my part early on in the study caused the volunteers to be a little defensive and a little more cautious about, you know, fully disclosing, you know, some of the most interesting aspects of their experiences. You know, so after a while, I began to perform a, you know, thought experiment, as it were, and began to treat the reports as if, you know, they were reports of, you know, real experiences. And afterwards, I could decide how to, you know, put that, you know, hypothesis into some cogent model. But in the meantime, as a result of, you know, treating their reports as reports of, you know, real things, I was able to, you know, reestablish, you know, the comfort zone, you know, between the volunteers and me, and, you know, they were much more comfortable in, you know, describing the, you know, entire spectrum of what, you know, they had just undergone.
Did you have, when you began changing your model of interaction, was that a, that sounds like it's a bit of a problem from a clinical research point of view. Was that, did that become a problem when you disclosed your findings, or was it just allowed to be as it is, just so that you could get the material that you needed?
Well, I mean, as the study was, you know, progressing, I was just, you know, collecting notes, you know, I would, you know, take, you know, very careful notes, you know, so in a way it didn't, you know, really impact my performing the research, or even, you know, my reporting it, you know, because I was just, you know, describing what the volunteers were describing. But I think what started to impact me personally was kind of the strangeness and the strange consistency of the strangeness of the reports of the research, you know, subjects. And I guess, you know, taking their reports at face value, I felt I was starting to enter into this very strange world, which I couldn't quite understand. Like, you know, if you're dealing with schizophrenics or other psychotic patients, it's, you know, pretty easy to discard or dismiss what they're talking about as some kind of brain dysfunction. But in the case of my volunteers, you know, there were doctors and lawyers and psychologists and, you know, teachers and, you know, quite sophisticated people, as smarter than I, you know, was or am at the time. And, you know, they were describing these things in a really matter-of-fact way, and I couldn't, you know, disregard their accounts as some brain aberration, especially because I had, you know, taken on the stance of, you know, kind of accepting at face, you know, value the reports, you know, that they came back with. So, you know, I felt in, you know, some ways like I had opened Pandora's box and wasn't quite sure what was going on, which, you know, was one of the reasons that I ended my study when I did.
Interesting. This new book touches upon the Hebrew Bible, and in the very beginning of the book, you describe a vision that the Hebrew prophet Ezekiel experiences. And I'm just curious, was that description kind of an aha moment for you, or a trigger point where you said, this may be, this prophecies may be something I can grab onto because it's a human experience described in the Bible by these people, and it's very similar to what my volunteers have experienced. Is that the kind of the foundation, beginning of the foundation?
Well, I don't think quite that it occurred in that, you know, sequence. I think, you know what, well, there's a couple of things we should touch upon first. You know, one is, you know, the whole, you know, concept of, you know, prophecy in the Hebrew Bible. You know what it means, you know, what the definition is. Well, because, you know, most of your readers or, you know, most of your listeners are, you know, thinking about, you know, prophecy as predicting or foretelling or, you know, predict or, you know, kind of divination, you know, foretelling the future. You know, but that is an artifact of the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek, which was the first, you know, non-Hebrew language, you know, that the Old Testament appeared in. And on the Hebrew, and, well, so the Hebrew word for prophet is Navi, and it you know, comes from a three-letter root, which means to interpret or to communicate or to transmit information. Be a spokeswoman, you know, and it, you know, doesn't imply anything to do, you know, with prediction or foretelling, you know, but the Greeks at the time, you know, the Greek translation occurred at around 150 BCE or so, and, you know, the Greeks were interested in spiritual experience or profoundly altered states as a means of predicting the future. You know, so they, you know, translated the Hebrew word Navi into prophetes, which means to speak before something happens. And, you know, that was a result of their interest in what is called, you know, divination or, you know, some kind of divine communication to be able to predict. And, you know, that kind of limits the definition of, you know, prophecy, especially when you're looking at it from the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible point of view. You know, so my definition of prophecy is, you know, simply any spiritual experience undergone by any figure in the Hebrew Bible. You know, so that could be like a handmaid or a servant or a, you know, soldier. You know, or it, you know, can be a description of a spiritual experience, you know, by one of, you know, the canonical prophets like Ezekiel or Isaiah or Jeremiah. Even Adam or Moses or Daniel, all those characters experience, you know, prophetic consciousness. You know, so that, you know, extremely or, you know, manifestly, you know, widens, you know, the net, you know, for, you know, being able to compare the DMT state with the prophetic state if you include any, you know, kind of spiritual altered state in the Bible. And with respect, you know, to that first chapter of Ezekiel where his original epiphany takes place, you know, I, well, so I started, you know, to read the Hebrew Bible in 1996 or so, which was at around the time I was being, I guess, excommunicated, you know, from my Zen community because of speaking about it. And I've been writing about, you know, publicly, you know, the relationship between the psychedelic, you know, drug state and, you know, beginning Buddhist practice at the very least, if not, you know, maintaining Buddhist practice or accelerating Buddhist practice. You know, so I had a bad taste in my mouth around that time about Buddhism and thought, well, you know, I wonder if there's, you know, some other system out there which would, number one, be able, you know, to incorporate the DMT effect, and number two, you know, be a bit more open, you know, minded about, you know, the whole idea. You know, so I went into this, you know, bookstore. I was living in Port Townsend, you know, Washington at the time. And, you know, there was a huge, you know, New Age bookstore there called Phoenix Rising. It's a great store. You know, my wife was having an affair. I'd just been kicked out of my Buddhist community. And I was, you know, kind of aimlessly, you know, walking up and down the aisles. And there's huge aisles on Hinduism and, you know, racks and, you know, racks of, you know, books on the occult. And I said, you know, I'm kind of burned out on this stuff. You know, anything on Judaism? Yeah, because I'm Jewish and I was raised Jewish. And, you know, so I, you know, walked upstairs and there's like 20 books on Judaism. And, you know, one of them, you know, was a little, you know, book with a turquoise cover called The Kabbalah of Envy. And I thought, well, you know, I could see that. You know, so I opened up the book and it really was quite profound. It, you know, I was just kind of skimming through it, and, you know, there were descriptions of human interactions which were microcosm of spiritual interactions and interplay, you know, the relationship between the divine and the human being played out in human interactions as opposed to, you know, mystical, unitive kinds of states. You know, so I... bought the book, went home, started studying it, and I was really drawn in, you know, because it was a, you know, it was a, you know, system of, you know, relatedness which bespoke deep spiritual truths and deep spiritual realities, which I hadn't quite, you know, found in over 20 years of Buddhist practice and study. You know, because the emphasis in, you know, Buddhism is on enlightenment, which is a unitive state. And, you know, the emphasis in, you know, Judaism is on, you know, the relationships which are occurring in your human and your spiritual, you know, worlds. You know, so I started getting an inkling, you know, that there was a system here which was more relevant, you know, to my research as well as, you know, personally fulfilling. You know, so, you know, once I, you know, kind of got over, you know, being, you know, given the boot, I was able to, you know, kind of devote myself, you know, more in a more, you know, focused, you know, way to look at the Hebrew Bible. And as I was going through the text, you know, which is pretty impenetrable if you don't have, you know, the aid of, you know, the commentaries to help you understand what the text is saying. You know, but the idea of a prophetic state of consciousness also started dawning on me. It was interactive. It was relational. It, you know, seemed like a DMT, you know, trip in some ways. You know, there were visions. You know, there were voices. There was experiences of being out of body. There was inspiration. But I really wasn't sure. And it maybe took another, you know, 10 years before I, you know, took the plunge and said, okay, I'm going to just go through the Bible one more time and compare everybody's reports in the Bible of prophetic states with every report of my DMT volunteer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, lo and behold, and with a huge, you know, sigh of relief, you know, my theory actually, you know, held up. You know, but it was, you know, I think it was close to, you know, 10 years later, after I, you know, began reading the Bible that I actually, you know, put my theory to the test, you know, that there was a, you know, content, you know, similarity to the very least between the two states.
Let's talk about that for a minute. Obviously, your volunteers had a DMT-induced state, and these prophets in the Hebrew Bible had, would you say, similar descriptions? Obviously not the alien abduction, but states of consciousness that maybe paralleled your volunteers? And then I have a two-part to that, too, which would be, do you believe that they were using or ingesting plants to create these states?
Well, you know, with respect to the comparison, you know, I started off using the criteria or the categories for spiritual experience, or you know, for a, you know, highly altered state of consciousness, with the categories I had developed for my DMT study, and I'm actually developed those categories based on principles of Buddhist psychology, combined with the mental status examination that everybody learns in their psychiatric and in their medical training, and those categories included things like perceptual effects, especially visual and auditory, somatic effects, physical, kinds of responses being hot or cold, light or heavy, and emotional effects being happy or sad or scared or peaceful, willful effects, like effects on volition, being able to interact, cognitive
right.
effects, being able to think more clearly or more, muddled or faster or slower. Form, feeling, consciousness, perception, understanding. So I then, started comparing, I began, looking at the reports of, figures in the Hebrew Bible experiencing their own spiritual states, and would, put, descriptions into those DMT bins, if Ezekiel, was reporting, trembling, I would then, put that into the bin of somatic effects. If, there were, mm-hmm. Visions of a blue light, I would put that into perceptual effects. In that kind of a process, there was a really striking overlap, a striking degree of, similarity. I would say 80-90% overlap. And, you were kind of, joking about, well, they didn't have alien abduction experiences, but they kind of did in a way. One of the categories which I then developed as I was going through this kind of side by side comparison, was a new category of what I called relatedness, which described the nature of the interactions between the beings and the person, the experience. If you read the alien abduction literature, there's testing and there's probing, and there's healing,
right.
and there's reassuring, there's harm being done and there's help being provided, those kinds of interactions would take place between the DMT volunteers and the beings, descriptions that you come across in the alien abduction literature. And, if you consider the time and the place and the context of these experiences that the figures in the Bible were going through, they could be seen as, overlapping, demonstrating a certain kind of equivalence.
Mm. Not having read the Hebrew Bible, though, would you say in the Bible that the prophecies are more written as visions, or are they more lessons for living a right life, do these individuals get information that is later thought of as a vision for something that's going to happen?
Well, I can answer that, but let me answer, on your last question, from the last.
Oh, round. Sure. Go ahead.
You were, wondering if the prophetic figures use plants or drugs in order to attain their state.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't any evidence in the Hebrew Bible, for the use of any mind-altering substance other than wine. Or liquor, what's called strong wine or strong drink. People have speculated, that there may have been cannabis in the incense, which was used in the tabernacle and in the temple. Some people have speculated, that there was an ergot alkaloid, kind of like LSD, in the manna, that the Hebrews, were consuming for, 40 years in the desert. And, some people have speculated about, Moses's, burning bush, being an acacia plant, which released, DMT vapors. But, if you look at, naturally occurring DMT in the body, that kind of dispenses with, needing to establish an outside source of a mind-altering substance. The body makes DMT. You could speculate, and it's pure speculation, that the figures in the Hebrew Bible, generated, a larger than normal amount of, DMT activity. And, that was responsible, for the visions and the voices, which, they describe. It may turn out to be the case, that certain plants or drugs or substances were used, but I think that's really, going to be hard to prove. And you don't have to, prove that the body makes DMT. That's known. It's been known for 60 years. But the conditions under which, naturally occurring, DMT activity would increase. Obviously is the critical question. Mm-hmm. So could you repeat that last question about, the spoken versus the visions?
Yeah, I think the point I was trying to make was that the visions that these people in the Bible have I think the point I was going to make is they're somewhat similar to what you describe in your volunteers, except that my question was, are those interpreted in the Bible as later becoming a law, turning into law, or they have, like, the Greeks had various states of mind where they interpreted certain visions, which later became ways to live by. The gods were in telling them how to live their life in a certain way. And I'm just wondering if these prophets, as they're described in the Bible, had these visions, which later were made into ways to live by. I guess that's the way to say it.
Yeah. So that kind of leads us in to the issue of the prophetic content, content of the visions and the voices. As compared, to the message, which is contained in that form. Because obviously, people that use DMT, they have visions, but they're not prophets, and, what they say isn't written down, necessarily to be studied and used as a way to live your life or to predict the future or to teach certain, theological or cosmological truths. So it's the information, content, which, somebody is able to extract, from the visions. And in the case of the Hebrew, the case of the Hebrew Bible, there is a ranking of, superiority of the prophets. The most superior prophet was Moses. And only in the beginning of his mission, did he actually experience visions. The rest of the time was, mostly just, verbal exchange with God or with, God's intermediaries or angels. There were just a few sporadic visions, like his initial theophany, was visual. And he also, saw some things which, helped him describe how to build implements in the tabernacle. But, mostly it was the transmission of, teachings, laws, primarily, the ways, for the Hebrews, to live their lives and, how to understand the nature of both the spiritual and, the physical, worlds around them. But after Moses, there weren't any more laws, handed down. The canonical prophets were, mostly, teaching people or admonishing people to follow the laws, which had already been laid down, especially the Golden Rule.
Right.
And also, you know, to abolish idolatry, which, you know, had already been, you know, taught by Moses, but was a difficult, you know, teaching, you know, to maintain. So, there were some predictions, you know, that the other prophets, you know, taught, like Ezekiel and Isaiah, Jeremiah, you know, Moses predicted as well. But, you know, you can be a prophetic figure without predicting, and you can predict without being a prophetic figure. And even if you are, or even if you do experience a, you know, prophetic state, and within that state there are some predictions, you know, sometimes those predictions come true, you know, sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes, you know, the predictions are incredibly vague and you have no idea what they're saying. You know, so you really aren't able to, you know, determine if they've come true or they will come true or they have or they won't or, you know, whatnot. So I think, you know, on the content, you know, the information content is, you know, critical. And, you know, that, you know, kind of depends on one's, one's intellectual strengths, you know, one's understanding,
right.
You know, one's intellect. And, you know, that could either be, you know, developed, you know, to the optimal level through training and education, you know, which would then, you know, help you interpret what the meaning of the visions is. Or in the case of my model, you know, the enhanced, you know, DMT activity, which is responsible for the visions and, you know, the voices could be divinely induced or stimulated, at which time, you know, the intellect is also divinely enhanced or stimulated, which, you know, then allows the person to extract, you know, the divine information that's being, you know, represented in the visions and voices.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. In your book, you actually come up with a phrase that I guess is an extract of your research, and you describe it as theoneurology. Can you explain to us, the audience, what that means on levels of consciousness?
Yeah. Well, I'm developed that, you know, model. Theoneurology is kind of a, you know, top-down counterpoint, you know, to the prevailing model of the relationship between biology and spiritual experience. You know, the prevailing model is what is called, you know, neurotheology, which proposes, you know, that the brain responds to certain stimuli with a, you know, physiological state, which is then, you know, translated, you know, subjectively into an experience, you know, which is, you know, then, you know, which is then, you know, kind of after the fact, I'm interpreted as spiritual. You know, so those stimuli, you know, could be prayer, fasting, meditation, you know, psychedelic drugs, and you know, the brain is configured that way, you know, because those kinds of experiences have got, you know, some evolutionary advantages. You might be more creative, you might be altruistic, you know, so it's kind of a, you know, bottom-up, you know, kind of model.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, so it's, you know, the brain is, you know, generating the impression of communicating with God, and, you know, that, you know, can help the species evolve. You know, but my model is a top-down model, and so I developed it as like a counterpoint, you know, rather than a replacement model. It allows, you know, someone with a spiritual worldview who believes in God and, you know, believes in the communication between God and humans, model to understand spiritual experience in general, and, you know, specifically, you know, the prophetic experience. And, you know, so this, you know, model, you know, theoneurology, you know, proposes, you know, that God designed the brain or configured the brain in, you know, such a way as to be able to communicate with us. You know, so, you know, God, you know, communicates with us, you know, through the agency of the brain. And, you know, DMT may play a role in, you know, mediating or being responsible, you know, for the form or the content of, you know, that communication. You know, so that helps explain a, you know, number of things. It explains, you know, why the brain is configured that way. You know, because if you look at the prophetic experience, it isn't especially, you know, pleasant or inspiring, especially early on in the text. You know, and, you know, and, you know, some of the laws, you know, absolutely make, you know, so they make absolutely no sense. You know, there's a, you know, couple of, you know, laws that were handed down by Moses, you know, like the law of the ashes of the red heifer, you know, being purifying but, you know, contaminating at the same time. You know, so there really isn't an evolutionary advantage, you know, to being, you know, taught that, you know, kind of thing that isn't altruism, that isn't, you know, creativity. You know, so it, you know, can help explain, you know, the message of the Hebrew Bible from a top-down, you know, model. You know, it isn't only a, you know, biological, you know, need which is being, you know, manifested, but it's a spiritual communication which is, you know, taking place. And, you know, the meaning, you know, might occur, you know, sometime, you know, later in the future.
Yeah.
It also allows one to include in, you know, the discussion of spiritual experience, you know, the presence of God, which, you know, the pure, you know, biological, you know, one is, you know, careful to sidestep in order to include a, you know, secular, you know, mechanistic, you know, what kind of audience, as opposed to the more, you know, spiritually oriented ones.
Okay. Yeah. Let me just ask you, after all your research and all your study groups, do you believe there are higher realms that are seeking to communicate with us, and this is just another method?
Well, I think it bespeaks, you know, the question of the model. You know, is the DMT world and the DMT beings and you know, the beings encountered in the DMT state purely subjective? In other words, are, you know, they just an artifact of brain physiology? Or do they reflect our, you know, or, well, do they reflect actual external objective, you know, things, which are out, you know, which exist outside of us, you know, but can only be perceived right now anyway, you know, through our minds. So I think as time has gone on, I'm kind of leaning more towards the objective reality, you know, side of things, but I'm, you know, tempering, you know, that belief with the understanding, you know, that our ability, you know, to perceive those externally real objective things is, you know, tempered, you know, by our, you know, by the condition of our, of our mind, specifically our capacity to imagine and our capacity to think, which are the two, you know, functions which I think have to be ideally developed in order to, you know, see these things through a clear window, you know, rather than, you know, looking at them as if, you know, we're looking into a mirror, you know, just our own reflection. You know, so, you know, there are a, you know, number of, you know, ways of, you know, beginning to, you know, think about the difference between objective and, you know, subjective. In, you know, my DMT book, you know, to some extent, and, you know, not, you know, quite to the same extent in my new book, I speculate about a dark matter camera, for example, which, you know, might be able to, you know, photograph images of the, you know, contents of dark, of, you know, dark matter. You know, there's this, you know, concept in, you know, contemporary, you know, physics, you know, that the, you know, 90%, you know, plus or minus of the matter of the universe is invisible. It neither reflects light or generates light. You know, so if that's the case, it makes sense that it's inhabited. It's got contents, even though we aren't able to measure it at this point. But sometime in the future, we might be able to take pictures of what's in dark matter. And if that were the case, we could then theoretically compare what that camera captures with the descriptions of visions of either the DMT or the prophetic state. And indeed, if DMT allows one to perceive things in dark matter or some parallel levels of reality, through the physiological or the pharmacological changing of the receiving characteristics of the mind-brain complex, that would go a long way, to explaining the existence and the nature of these normally invisible realms and their denizens.
What's the definition of dark matter? Is that the consciousness we cannot see, but it's communicating with us?
So it is matter, but it's invisible because it's not producing light or reflecting light. It's the vast majority of the matter or of the mass of the universe is dark. It's invisible. We can't see it. We're spending billions of dollars with these dark matter detectors, buried deep within the earth to to detect these things called neutrinos, which are theoretical particles of dark matter. So the brain is obviously a lot more complicated and sophisticated machine than any machine that we can develop at this point. So it is tempting to speculate that you can fine tune the receiving characteristics of the mind brain complex pharmacologically, and it would then be able to peer into dark matter more effectively than these machines could.
In your book, you do discuss the shaman's visions, the shaman's perspective. For hundreds of years, we've been led to believe that shamans went into hallucinogenic, they went into states of consciousness with ayahuasca and other DMT-related types of drugs, and brought back intelligent information from various spirits and plants and animal kingdom. And that is how very crude and rudimentary civilizations apparently got by, was through the visions of the shaman. Do you think after your research that that's a valid assessment of how they got that information, or did they get it in some other manner? Because there's a number of authors who touch on that subject of shamanistic visions.
Right. I think that's possibly the case. But if you take into account the existence of endogenous DMT that the body makes on its own, you wouldn't, necessarily, need to rely on external agents like, plants, drugs, things that you would be, taking in from the outside. Terence McKenna speaks about that, the late, monkeys, early humans consumed, psilocybin mushrooms and were able to, visualize, sounds. They could see, sounds, coming out of their mouth and then start manipulating them. And, that was, the development of language. But, that can occur, or, those, kinds of, visions occur, without the use of, drugs. There's a number of episodes in the Hebrew Bible of the prophetic figures, seeing letters, seeing words, form in space. You know, so one of the early scholars of, you know, shamanism, you know, Mircea Eliade, speaks about, you know, drug use as kind of a, you know, decadent, you know, form of, you know, shamanism. And, you know, so he, you know, teaches, you know, that, you know, trance, you know, self-induced, you know, trance is, you know, the more pristine and, you know, the original, you know, form of shamanism, you know, before you started, you know, having to use, you know, drugs or plants. You know, so I think it, you know, is still up in the air or still is open to speculation, you know, which is the higher, you know, form of shamanism. But at the same time, you know, I do, you know, kind of address, you know, shamanism, especially the current incarnation of Latin American ayahuasca shamanism, as a model for understanding the DMT effect. And it's got some strengths. It, you know, proposes, you know, the reality of the spiritual, of the spiritual, you know, levels, which, or, you know, the spiritual, you know, levels of reality, which, you know, people seemingly encounter in the DMT state. You know, so that is an advantage over the Buddhist or psychoanalytic or the psychopharmacologic model. You know, but okay. One of the drawbacks is it, you know, primarily is, you know, working with the spirits of nature, and specifically, you know, to manipulate them, you know, for good or for ill, but still, it, you know, kind of has an occult kind of basis, you know, that you're tapping into these forces to use them, as opposed to being, you know, taught, you know, by them. You know, you're taught, you know, songs and, you know, teachings and, you know, whatnot, but those are more specifically, you know, for purposes, you know, to heal somebody or to harm somebody. You know, so it isn't quite, you know, the same thing as being, you know, transmitted an ethical or a moral, you know, system of belief and behavior as occurs in the prophetic literature. I'm also, you know, shamanism isn't, you know, theistic. It doesn't, you know, believe at least, you know, any of the, you know, varieties I've, you know, come across. You know, doesn't, you know, believe in the one God. And I, you know, think if you're going to be getting traction using a model for the psychedelic state, it, you know, needs to be, you know, one that people on a mass scale can relate to. And, you know, the majority of, you know, people in the world believe in God. You know, they read the Bible, you know, more or less closely. And if it's going to be, you know, looked on, or, you know, looked at as, you know, pagan or idolatrous or, you know, polytheistic, I don't think it'll get the same kind of traction at the large scale that is, you know, necessary to, you know, really, you know, transform planetary consciousness, as would be the case with, you know, the more, you know, traditional Abrahamic religions out there.
Let me ask you, you just brought up something, planetary consciousness. Do you have a sense in your research of the evolution of consciousness, and maybe do you have a glimpse, and can you write about what you think or where our consciousness is going in terms of our, well, of our evolution? I mean, what do you see is a possibility, or do you not speculate in that area?
I do speculate, but it's kind of, well, yeah, it's, you know, grounded in, you know, both the Hebrew Bible and in, you know, DMT, you know, physiology and, you know, genetics and, you know, pharmacology. Yeah, you know, it's, you know, it is, you know, clearly, it is, you know, clearly hit or miss, I think, if, you know, good is going to prevail, or more on the contrary, if, you know, like if evil is going, you know, to prevail. But if you are, you know, banking on, you know, good prevailing in the course of evolution, you know, there's speculation in the Hebrew Bible about what's called the Messianic era, which is an era of peace, and you don't have to eat, you don't have to drink, there's no procreation. You're just, you know, kind of able to, you know, bask in the glory of God, as it were. You can study, you can relate to angels. You know, so if you look at descriptions of the Messianic era or the world to come, you know, it's, you know, it is described using both expressions. It shares certain features with the DMT state. It's non-corporeal. You don't have physical needs or requirements. It's made of light. The descriptions often include descriptions of a world of light. And everybody prophesies. There's no more prophecy because everybody prophesies. Kind of a paradoxical manner. There isn't anything that stands out as prophecy because everybody is in that state all of the time. And if you look at some of the recent discoveries regarding DMT, there's a specific gene which is responsible for the production of the enzyme, which is necessary for DMT synthesis. That was discovered in 1999, 2000. They're discovering what turns it off. And it is, interesting to speculate about, if there was some stimulus which, turned on this gene in every organism that contained it at the same time, that in some ways would usher in a non-corporeal, non-physical state, for all of those organisms, which would be characterized by the features of the DMT experience.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's a bit weird.
Okay.
Of an idea,
well,
but
I think that's great. I actually wanted to just get Dr. Rick Strassman's personal point of view after all this research and these clinical studies about what you felt our consciousness was evolving towards. But I think that's, you may not feel comfortable giving your own personal opinion, rather just say, hey, this is what I see. But it's always nice to hear from the man himself. So if you want to give us your point of view, I'd love to hear it.
Are you asking me if I've used DMT?
Well, oh, that's funny you asked that. In the very beginning, I was going to ask you if you have. Have you experimented with it?
Well, that's a question I'm asked a lot, and I couldn't quite I couldn't quite read between the lines of your previous question, but it's a question I'm asked, and it's a question that I sidestep by saying
sure.
If I tell people I have, then I'm accused of being a zealot. And if I tell people I haven't, then I'm accused of not knowing what I'm talking about. So I suppose I also, kind of am interested in, why that's important and what difference it makes.
It doesn't make, honestly, I didn't bring it up in the beginning. I think more to the point is here you are, you've conducted this research, you have absorbed the visions of your volunteers, and then you followed it up with the prophetic visions of these Hebrew prophets. And I guess I would really be interested to know, based on all this 2 decades plus of work, if you see patterns that you personally find a positive, or you even brought up something that I wasn't even thinking about, the good and the evil versus good, which is so much was not what I was thinking. It was more as conscious beings, are we going to a level where we begin to look and see other dimensions, or we see and talk with or begin to get a hint of what people call their higher self or their spirits that apparently we're all born with, if you believe some of the traditions of the metaphysical realms. So I guess just a little insight into you personally about what you feel would be, really be kind of nice. But I'm open to anything you have to say.
I'm still not quite sure what your question is, but that's never stopped me before. I think we ought to, consider, resurrecting, the prophetic stream. At around the time of the Second Temple, like around, the turn of the Common Era, 2,000 years ago, the rabbis declared the end of prophecy. They kind of closed the book on it, despite the fact that, they had their own prophetic experiences and, people, throughout, the Middle Ages and even, contemporary, Jewish, mystics and rabbis and scholars, describe their own, prophecy-like experiences. But it was kind of relegated, to the sidelines. It, wasn't the mainstream of Jewish, thinking or behavior or, teaching anymore. And, there were a number of reasons, that was the case. I think, primarily political, but, we can, talk about that. And I also go into that in my new book. But I think, that's kind of, developing right now. There is, research going on at a number of, universities in the U.S. at Johns Hopkins and at NYU, where, they're looking at, they're looking at, giving psilocybin to people in order to induce a mystical experience. And, their model is, is the mystical unitive state. It isn't the, it isn't the interactive relational state. So they're kind of getting there. I think there's a number of, reasons to, focus on the mystical unitive state when you're doing psychiatric research, because it's, purely descriptive. It's, emotional, it's cognitive, physical, and it kind of, sidesteps the entire, message of the interactive relational state, which the prophetic experience is, paradigmatic of. These, research, projects are beginning to, branch out into giving psilocybin to clerics, which will include, rabbis and priests, ministers, monks, lamas. So I think what will start to occur is, some kind of, psychedelic, some kind of, psychedelic stimulation of the messages that are contained within the, within the minds of the clerics, and in, the case of the Jewish clerics and, the Christian clerics, that'll be the prophetic message, as opposed to all as one, which, the Buddhist, kind of, New Age model has, used to co-opt, this research up until now. I think we'll have to start, looking at what these, these research, subjects and these academic, projects are going to actually be talking about. At the same time, it, could be that the mystical unitive state has, so, co-opted even, the religious view of the clerics who might volunteer for these kinds of studies, that they'll talk about the unitive mystical state, primarily as opposed, to the content, the content, full experience of, the prophetic one. But still, it's going to be an interesting development. And it, may stimulate, the, reintroduction of the prophetic message as well as the prophetic experience into the mainstream, by means of academic psychiatric research.
Amazing. Fantastic. My guest today has been Rick Strassman, Dr. Rick Strassman, and the book, the new book, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. It's very, very interesting. It's got a lot of material, and I appreciate you being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Cliff. So one more thing. You're asking about the evolution of things. I was kind of speaking about the academic, setting. You give, drugs, and you can, kind of reproduce a particular state. But
sure.
I think also, it will be important to, turn that on its head as well. So what I mean by that is, if you are a student of the Bible, but you don't understand, what it's saying at the kind of level that you would like to, you know, it makes, you know, sense to, you know, think about the state of mind out of which, you know, the text emerged, was, you know, which is a, you know, prophetic state. And, you know, to the extent that the prophetic and the psychedelic state resemble each other, you could, you know, recommend or, you know, suggest that the careful use of, you know, psychedelics, you know, would allow entry, you know, into certain aspects of the mind out of which, out of which, you know, the text originally emerged. You know, so you would be able to increase your understanding of the text in that way. You know, so that's, you know, kind of the, you know, other side of the coin.
Interesting.
So that was the interview with Dr. Rick Straussman. I hope you were able to extract some bits of wisdom from that talk. It got a little clinical, and I was working to get his point of view, but as a clinician who's still doing this research, obviously he didn't want to say that he was using a DMT, which it makes sense because if he's being funded by universities, they don't want the lead clinician to be saying, hey, I'm dropping a DMT, I'm shooting up a DMT, and I'm tripping too. The work continues. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and we'll get something out of it. It was, I thought it was kind of interesting. So that's it for today's show. Keep an eye on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Be sure to see the updates on the Penang Ganang tour. I just found some new photographs that I didn't post from Dr. Danny Hillman on some of the extraction points, the excavation points that he had sent me that I didn't get a chance to post. And according to Bruce, and he told me this offline a couple of days ago, that the people who tour will be able to actually go to these excavation sites, which is very rare. Most of the time they keep them closed off, but you'll be able to see where some of these rooms originate. And I don't think they've gotten to the point where you can go into one of the rooms. That would be really bad to have people do that, especially when they don't know what's in there. So anyhow, Ancient Mysteries International, 260 is the phone number, area code 260-417-8548. And I would like to hope that you can try to get out there if you can. One other thing, we're going to be organizing some trips to Mexico. He just told me that he wants me to put together a tour. That would be wonderful because then I can show you some of the key points in Mayan archaeology and some of these what I call meditation points, where if you close your eyes, you are taken pretty deeply into a meditative state, whether you meditate or not. So that means that some of these pyramids are actually active. And I've been told this by the elders that the pyramids in the Yucatan Peninsula, and I'll give you the names of them, Chichen Itza, Inushmal, and Coba, which all have major pyramids, are active. So can you believe that? Wow. Hey, have a great Saturday, and we'll talk to you next time.